When you wrote your book, I understand you had access to tapes that Louis Armstrong had made. Were these tapes just recently available to people?
The tapes have been available for a number of years, but I was the first biographer to have access to them. Armstrong was one of the very first people in America to own a tape recorder. He bought his first tape recorder in 1947 to tape his shows. But then he started playing with it and using it for other things. And by the end of his life, he had accumulated more than 600 reels of tape, many of which contain private and sometimes very intimate conversations with his wife, with friends, things like that. And I was able to listen to these tapes and use them for the biography. And I didn't know Armstrong in life. I'm too young to have known him. But because I heard so much of him talking in situations like this, it really gave me a feel for what he was like off stage and how he talked. And that obviously was part of what inspired and went into this play.
Did the tapes give you new insights into who he was?
Oh, very much so. If you only know the public Armstrong, obviously you know the genius, the great musician. But if, you know, I'm 56, so I'm old enough to have seen him on television, seen him in movies. And what you saw was the entertainer, this great, smiling, genial man. And that wasn't false. He was that kind of person. But he was more than that. He was also a genius, an artist, you know, a sensitive man, a man who was capable of great anger, of holding grudges, and a man who swore like a trooper, and then some. This is not something that you would see on the Ed Sullivan Show. And because I knew about Armstrong in this way, and because that informed my book so deeply, when I decided that I wanted to try to write a play about him, I knew that part of what I was going to need to do was introduce the audience to the offstage Armstrong, the private Armstrong. And I knew that they would be startled by this, because unless they'd read my book, they would have no idea about this side of his personality.
Do you think that his public persona kind of overshadowed and perhaps undervalued some of the serious contributions he made, both musically and personally?
Many people felt that way, especially blacks not of his generation, but who were born later. Remember, Armstrong was born in 1901. The world was very different then. A younger generation of black musicians, like Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis, although they esteemed him as an artist, didn't like the way he behaved on stage, which was like an entertainer. They saw him as being an Uncle Tom figure, which he hated. He didn't believe that was true. It angered him enormously and made him angry at both of these men. This is part of what happens in the play. We see him talking about them, and we see Miles Davis as a character in the play. I think for a lot of people who are younger and who have no clear sense of the way that the world has changed, if they see an Armstrong performance, you know, they're going to think that there's something old-fashioned about it that somehow disconnects with the quality of the music that's being made. I hope part of what my play does is help them to understand the context in which Armstrong functioned on the stage. No matter how he comes across as a performer, the music is the heart of the matter, and his personality, his offstage personality, is completely consistent with the music. You know, it's fun, it's lively, he loved life, but he also understood the darkness and dangers of life, and that too is in his music. In the play, Armstrong is telling the story of his life at the end of his life, and I think in a way trying to justify his life to himself and to whoever is listening, the audience, which I imagine is a single person in the dressing room. And one of the things that it's really important to him to explain is that far from being an Uncle Tom, he was a very brave person who took considerable personal and professional risks in order to be, as he says in the play, someone who did great things uplifting his race. And so we have a scene in the play where he does talk about the incident where, at the time of the Little Rock school desegregation crisis, you know, he spoke out in the bluntest, angriest terms possible about what the governor of Arkansas was doing. And the next day, he was in every newspaper in America from coast to coast.
I guess every artist's life informs their work. His life may have given him the ability to be so adaptable. He learned to play the cornet in reform school, and then he got out on this and was working in bands and in parades.
Armstrong was born in the gutter. He was the child of a part-time prostitute who lived in Black Storyville, which was the red light district of New Orleans at the turn of the century. His father deserted the family very early. Armstrong remembered it as the day he was born. And if nothing had happened to him, if he'd just been born and he hadn't gotten any kind of stroke of luck, he probably would have, as he said, ended up on the gallows. Instead, he was arrested at the age of 12 for firing off a gun on New Year's Eve. He was put in the Colored Waifs Home, which was a kind of reform school for black children. And he got his first musical instrument, a cornet, and was taught how to play. And that was the great transforming, changing point of his life. He was aware of music. He even had a kind of battered cornet that he played with that he'd gotten in a pawn shop. But this was the first time when he really was put in a disciplined situation and the door was opened to a life of music for him. And because he was a natural-born genius, he seized this opportunity. And within a matter of years, he was the up-and-coming musician in New Orleans. The great break was when Joe Oliver, King Oliver, who had been the top cornet player in New Orleans and who had gone up to Chicago and was big there, asked him to come to Chicago and join Oliver's band. Had that not happened, Armstrong, again, might have spent his whole life in New Orleans, and he might have been perfectly happy. I mean, he was a person who made the most of wherever he was, whatever he was doing. But coming to Chicago put him into the larger world. He made his first records a year later, and within a matter of 5 years, by 1927, 1928, he was known all over the country because of his recordings. Everybody who was interested in jazz knew who Louis Armstrong was. So that was the great moment, the moment when the key turned in the lock.
By that point, like 1927, he had gone to Chicago and then gone to New York and gone back again?
Yes, he came to Chicago. He went to New York briefly to play in Fletcher Henderson's band, came back to Chicago and established himself as a solo artist there. And then a couple of years later, he returned to New York and appeared in a Broadway show called Hot Chocolates. That was the next big moment because suddenly, up to that time, he was known to people who were interested in jazz, which is not a huge audience in 1927, 28. But he goes to New York in 1929, he does Hot Chocolates, and the song he sings in the show is Ain't Misbehavin'. So this was like a bomb exploding. Suddenly there was this man on Broadway that most people had never heard of, and you heard him and you fell in love. And from then on, the rocket went straight up.
What caused people to sit up and take notice of him in particular? Was it his trumpet playing, his singing, his scat singing?
To musicians, of course, the key to Armstrong was his trumpet playing. He wasn't the inventor of jazz, but he essentially forged the modern language of jazz. He was the first jazz musician really to swing in a modern way, one that we recognize today and respond to. To the public at large, it was the singing that made the difference, this wonderful gravelly voice. The fact that he was able to put his personality across so completely, even on a record when you couldn't see him. And then when he began making films in the early 30s with Bing Crosby and other people, and you could see him and you could see just how charismatic he was, that was the trigger that made him a mass entertainment star in a way that he hadn't been before. He was popular by the time he made his first film. But once you could see him and hear him at the same time, that made all the difference in the world.
And so I was talking to someone who said, well, he's sometimes considered the father of jazz, but this person was saying there were other people like Buddy Bolden and people that he learned from, but he took that tradition and popularized it because he happened to be at a perfect place where technology was such that recordings were starting to be made. Is that, do you think that he benefited from the time and place?
All that is true, but in a way it's a little bit beside the point. Armstrong is one of the second generation of jazz musicians. He heard Buddy Bolden when he was a very small boy. He learned from Joe Oliver, King Oliver, and from many other musicians in New Orleans. But it wasn't simply a matter of good timing. It was a matter that he was a creative genius who transformed and reshaped the language of early jazz. He was, along with Sidney Bechet, this happened to them at the same time, he was the first great jazz soloist. jazz was not the same after he started making records. And because those records were disseminated throughout the country and eventually throughout the world, he became the first great influence in the history of jazz. People wanted to play like him and sing like him.
Would you say that Armstrong's trajectory was linear or expansive in the sense that he was popular in the jazz community, everybody in the jazz community knew him, but then he branched out and started playing for white audiences and Broadway, and he started playing popular standards? Was it that he just expanded his repertoire?
There was never a moment in Louis Armstrong's life when he wasn't playing and singing jazz. The difference was who he played and sang it for and what his material was. He started out playing records that were aimed at a jazz audience. Then when he came to New York in 1929, he began expanding his repertoire and singing and playing and recording songs that later became great popular standards like Body and Soul. Armstrong is one of the people who made these songs popular along with Bing Crosby. He began to be managed in 1935 by Joe Glazer, and Glazer deliberately set out to establish him as a film and radio personality, to expand his audience, to get him playing for white people, which is where the money was, obviously, since there's so many more of them, and to try to broaden his appeal. But this was never done at the expense of Armstrong's capacity to make great music. That's something that's misunderstood by a lot of people. There are a lot of critics who think that once Armstrong stopped playing with the Hot Five and started working with a big band, that in some way he sold out to commercialism. Not at all. He actually made, I think, many, perhaps most of his greatest recordings after he started working with the big band.
He liked all different kinds of music, and he incorporated different elements or different aspects of music into his own style. I mean, is there a Louis Armstrong style?
Armstrong liked every kind of music there was. He was deeply influenced by opera. He was collecting recordings by opera singers when he was a boy in New Orleans. He recorded with Jimmy Rogers, and at the end of his life, performed on television with Johnny Cash. He had an insatiably curious ear. And as he said, he took all of this and turned it into his own music. This, too, I think, is part of why he became so remarkably popular a public figure. Because he could do anything that you might want him to do, but it was always him. His identity as a musician was never compromised by the fact that he was playing with a big band or with the New York Philharmonic or with a group of pop singers or anything. No matter what he did, it was all him.
For some people who aren't musicians, is there a way to describe the Louis Armstrong style, or is it just something that...
I think Armstrong's style inheres in two things. First, this irresistible forward propulsion, rhythmic propulsion, which jazz musicians call swing. He was, as I've said, the first jazz musician to really develop the modern sense of swing, and it was in his music ever after. Combined with that is a wonderful kind of warmth and expansiveness. He is a great personality. I said once that he's a great man who was also a good man, and you can feel this in his music. You can warm your hands on his singing. And this is what made him beloved, not just by his colleagues, not just by other musicians, but by people who knew nothing about jazz and people who still know nothing about jazz, but respond to that warmth and sincerity. You listen to a record like What a Wonderful World. There's a sense in which, obviously, it's not a jazz record. It's a sweet ballad. But you have a purely authentic jazz musician singing it. And it's that combination of warmth and the deep jazz feeling that energizes it and makes it so special. Or a record like Hello, Dolly, which, of course, was his greatest success. He knocked the Beatles off the number one spot in the Billboard charts when that single came out. But it's a pure jazz record being performed by the Little Dixieland Combo.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.